Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. We're back with Viet History Makers with my co-host Kevin Pham. Today, we are going to be talking about probably the biggest figure in modern Vietnamese history, which is Ho Chi Minh. And Kevin and I have been working very hard to build up to this episode. And I think there's a lot of trust that we hopefully built up along the way with our audience. And I bring that up because we want to make sure that we are sensitive to all sides when we bring a story, when we bring a life like Ho Chi Minh to our episodes.
That's really well said, Tan. Thanks. And to further set the tone for this episode, and we have a lot to discuss today, I do want to say a few things along with some caveats. So again, we don't have much time in these episodes. An hour, we can't discuss everything. So as for all the figures we discuss in this series, the aim really is limited and simple. It's to introduce them, their life, their ideas, and their significance. We will approach all of these figures in a spirit of goodwill and sympathy and critical mindedness. So Ken, actually, I wanted to bring this up to you, and I think this would be good to think about for the rest of our episodes. And I think this is good life advice in general. So do you know anything about the Rotary Club?
Yeah, I think my closest participation with the Rotary Club is, I think the Key Club is sort of a spinoff of the Rotary Club at the high school level. And I was the president of my chapter for like a few months, whatever, because they had just started it. So that's the, I think it's a service club, right? To clean up trash and, you know, do all these wonderful civic-minded activities in America.
Right. So I bring that up because I won a Rotary scholarship to do my master's in Amsterdam in 2011. And I went around to many Rotary clubs. And one thing about the Rotary Club is they have this thing called the four-way test. And as a good Rotary scholar, I memorized this. So here's the test. Of the things we think, say, and do, we should ask ourselves these four questions. Number one, is it the truth? Number two, is it fair to all those concerned? Three, will it build goodwill and better friendships? And four, will it be beneficial to all those concerned? And I think this is a good four-way test to have in mind as we approach these episodes. And what I especially like about this four-way test is because it seems that some of those four things actually might conflict. So it's up to you to balance them. So for example, it might be the truth that I think my friend looks terrible in their new outfit that they bought. But will I say the truth? And how will I say it? Will it build a better friendship? So now I have to find out a way to say the truth, but also build goodwill and benefit both me and them, right? So it takes imagination, takes creativity, thoughtfulness. So I think that's good. You agree?
I want to ask further, are we talking about the subject that we're talking about today to apply those four things, or are we talking about just the exercise of what we're doing in general?
In general, that's what we're going to do in general. So, okay, let's jump right into it, Ken. So
Well, actually, it's a few more caveats. So many, many, many books have been written about Ho Chi Minh, and I wanted to get out a few recommendations. So one really big one, an important one, is a big biography of Ho Chi Minh called Ho Chi Minh, A Life, and that's by William Diker. That's kind of one of the more famous ones. Another one is by a French scholar, French-Vietnamese, named Pierre Brochu, called Ho Chi Minh, A Biography. I actually met Pierre Brochu when he was 93 a few years ago, and he has recently passed away. He's a big figure in Vietnam studies. Another scholar is Olga Dror. She has many articles. And Tuong Vu, who you know, wrote an important book called Vietnam's Communist Revolution. And also another French scholar named Daniel Emery. Anyway, so I wanted to throw out those names. Now, in Vietnam, there is so much written about Ho Chi Minh. So much. In books, in articles, he's mentioned in speeches by politicians. And I will say that all of it very much tends to be hagiographic. And that word means technically the writing of the lives of saints. So it tends to be very, very much lots of praising and revering Ho Chi Minh. None of it is critical. It's quite, like, for example, you'll see books like Ho Chi Minh, A Brilliant Thinker, things like that, okay? So I mentioned those books by Western scholars above that because I do think they offer more nuance, maybe some more critique, potentially. It's less hagiographic is what I want to say.
You know, let me ask you something about this. How do we know when we're reading a book about anybody that we're reading the truth? You brought up truth earlier. How do we know if we're reading, like if you just blindly grabbed a book from a stack and we don't know if it's written from, you know, Vietnam or Vietnamese authors or a Western, how do we know? How do we verify that what we're reading is real?
Ken, this is a really important question. What I do when I pick up a book randomly is I look at the author, I look at the publisher, and me as a scholar, what I trust the most, and by the way, everything is not perfect. There are always flaws, but the way to minimize, the way to find out what's most dependable is, number one, is it a university press? Because through the university academic system in the West, there is a system of peer review, okay, where scholars read and critique each other's work, where you are trained in historiography, in you are trained to provide evidence, historical evidence, what is reliable as a source. There's all this rigorous cross-checking. Of course, again, none of it's perfect, but that's really kind of the best we have here. And so, and I mentioned the West because you do have outside of Europe and North America universities, but at the same time, Ken, many countries do not have the level of freedom of speech as Western countries do. So for example, in Vietnam, there is a one party in power, the Vietnamese Communist Party. And Vietnam, especially post-colonial nations, especially struggling nations, often the luxury that we in the West have of free speech is not there to the extent as it is in the US. Now, this is all to say that you should not ignore writings outside the West, obviously not. But you might also consider them to be even a primary source. Different writing has different aims as well. Some writing aims at promoting a political project, right? But scholarship aims at something different. Good scholarship, in my opinion. Good scholarship aims at understanding and shedding light on the facts and interpreting those facts. But if you're a nationalist, your goal might be to unify Vietnam by writing a story, by writing a historical narrative. You might present it as scholarly, but maybe you're motivated to present a certain narrative. Now, with that being said, I'm not saying at all that Western scholars don't do this.
Right.
You know, they might accidentally, subconsciously, of course, they have personal political opinions as well, and that will come through probably. Me personally, Ken, and I'm very different actually from some of my friends who are professors. I don't consider myself to be someone who's trying to push an ideology or a political. I mean, maybe I am actually. Who knows? You know, like I don't think anybody's free from this, but I'm pretty conscious of it. I try to present multiple sides. To answer your question really quickly, I think the best thing you could do as a reader is to read many different things and to make up your mind for yourself. So there's no such thing as objectivity, but there is such thing as taking a multi-biased 360-degree view. So try to engage as much propaganda as possible and scholarship and so on. So
yeah, there. And I think that's what we're going to try to do. That's what the aim is, and I'm glad you brought that up at the very end, is that we're going to try to get to all the viewpoints within the next, the time that we have allotted. But if we can't reach this, then we probably need to do a part two. And we love to hear from our audience if they have more questions after listening to this episode.
Yeah, good. But good question. Okay, let me, so much to talk about. Okay, Vietnam. In Vietnam, he's revered as a saint-like figure. He's the founder of modern Vietnam. And in every public school classroom, there's a portrait of him in the front. And I was talking to someone I know. She was born and raised in Vietnam. She's Vietnamese. And she was telling me, he's always looking down upon you like a god. And anytime you write his name, Bac Ho, you have to capitalize Bac Ho. And I talked to another Vietnamese person recently when I was in Vietnam, and she told me that if you did well in school in Vietnam as a kid, as a small kid, one reward, if you won like best student, was a trip to Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum in Hanoi. You know, these are school trips for the best students. You would win these awards. Okay, obviously he's praised in Vietnam. He's also praised all over the world. So if you go to the comment section of any YouTube video about Vietnamese history, a documentary, or about Ho Chi Minh, you're going to see admiration from all over the world. Also in the 1960s, there were many young activists in Europe and the United States who praised Ho Chi Minh, who were really pro-Ho Chi Minh. I know a professor who, in the 1960s, he told me he had a portrait of Ho Chi Minh in his locker. He's this white American professor, okay? Now, of course, however, Vietnamese Americans and other Vietnamese in the diaspora who either fought on the side of South Vietnam or sympathized with South Vietnam see Ho Chi Minh in a much more critical light, clearly. Now, let me bring up one episode. You probably know about this, Ken. Consider Vietnamese American protests in Southern California in 1999. Do you remember this?
Outrage. Really? Like it was yesterday. Yep.
So for listeners, outrage arose over a Vietnamese man's decision to display a portrait of Ho Chi Minh in this video store that he owned. And so thousands of Vietnamese came out into the streets of Southern California and they had protests. And some signs displayed Ho Chi Minh's face next to Adolf Hitler's. Now, let me step back. I don't think Ho Chi Minh is comparable to Hitler. Hitler wanted racial purity and to exterminate so-called inferior races. And I also want to say here that I think there's a reason why Ho Chi Minh is never included among popular understandings of monsters and tyrants in history. So if you Google, or if you try to find podcasts and documentaries about tyrants and dictators, they always mention Hitler, Mao, Pol Pot, Mussolini, Stalin, Saddam Hussein, never ever Ho Chi Minh. I tried this. I tried to look, but I never see Ho Chi Minh. Now, given how I grew up around my family, my anti-communist family, I actually grew up expecting to see him there, but he's not. Okay, but now,
just to be fair, I think if you're coming from the South Vietnamese government families, they do view him as a tyrant monster. However, I do think the timelines of sort of the people in power are kind of overlapping that gives him this sort of like this, you know, this overhyped, this overblown viewpoint that we, or villain perspective that we have in the diaspora, but we can get it done.
Yeah. Okay. I do also want to caveat here that I recognize that a lot of horrible things have been done in the name of communism. Ho Chi Minh identified as a communist. At the same time, I do not think this means that we should reject and take an anti-intellectual position towards communism and dismiss it as an evil idea. It's like Christianity. You know, horrible things have been done in the name of Christianity. Does this mean we should reject completely Christianity and Christians? No. Okay, so how do we understand the anti-Ho Chi Minh protests? I do want to spend a little bit more time here. And I want to bring up Duan Huang, who is a great scholar, professor in Southern California. And he teaches at Pepperdine, and he works on Vietnamese anti-communism. Actually, I would be surprised if you don't know Duan Huang.
I know him, yeah.
Okay, you do.
I know, yeah, Duan Huang, yes.
So to understand this Vietnamese anti-communist sentiment, Duan Huang says, we need to understand that Vietnamese anti-communism actually has a long, complex tradition. And at those protests, there was a scholar and interviewer who was interviewing organizers of the protests. And what this scholar discovered was that many of them who organized the protests and who were most passionate, they were associated with the South Vietnam regime, and they faced political persecution. Many of them were incarcerated in these so-called re-education camps. And in those camps, in the memoirs of ex-prisoners as well, they describe systemic dehumanization and cruelty committed by individuals acting in the name of Ho Chi Minh's revolution. So they describe these camps as using words like nightmare, akmo, darkness, and hell. And they referred to the camp officers and guards as animals and devils, red devils, gui da. And for some, Ho Chi Minh was far from being a democratic person. But in this episode, I do want to reconstruct how Ho Chi Minh understood himself. So he is going to say that he is trying to promote democracy. But of course, there are many anti-communist politicians in South Vietnam in the 50s who saw Ho Chi Minh as totally antithetical to democracy. They saw him as autocratic, and they themselves said they were promoting democracy. I remember asking one of my uncles who fought for the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. I said, what were the South Vietnamese fighting for? I know you were against communism, but what were you for? And he said to me, we were fighting for freedom and democracy. And what's really interesting here is when you start reading Ho Chi Minh was saying the exact same thing, using the exact same words, freedom and democracy. Okay, let me finish my caveat by saying there are many caricatures of Ho Chi Minh. He's a power-hungry zealot. He's a selfless patriot. He's a Machiavellian figure. He's a nationalist saint and so on. So for these reasons, Ho Chi Minh is going to be the thorniest of all the figures that we examine in this series. There's a cult of personality still today that remains around him, and the stakes of controlling his public image are very, very high today, even in Vietnam. Okay.
Right.
But I don't live in Vietnam. I feel free. I live in Amsterdam. I'm going to say what I think. Okay. So, and one way to sidestep these political minefields, in my view, for me, is to focus on interpreting writings that are attributed to him. So we're going to talk about his life, but I do want to focus on his writings and what he saw. Okay, I'm talking a lot here, so feel free to jump in anytime, Ked. Now, yeah.
We're trying to economize the episode, so I have to let you rip it, you know?
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions, but I think today is going to be one of those days where I'm going to have to really trim down on the questions because it could really derail us and maybe save it for part two.
Maybe. Yeah. You know, just raise your hand like a student, Ken. You are the student. So, okay. So Ho Chi Minh saw himself as trying to bring dignity back to the Vietnamese, and he saw himself as promoting what he calls democracy. So we're going to discuss his political vision, what he wanted for Vietnam. I'm not going to talk about how dignifying or democratic he actually was by his standards or by any other standards. So I'm just going to say what he thought, okay? Now, Ho Chi Minh never set out to create a systematic political theory. We don't see that in his writings. However, I'm going to say that theory is still happening in his writings. He offers a diagnosis of the cause of indignity, so racist dehumanization and exploitation of the Vietnamese, and a solution, a prescription for what the Vietnamese should do in order to bring back dignity, which is a communist revolution that rehumanizes them. Okay, now Ken, at this point, it's really important for listeners to think about what was it that Ho Chi Minh was responding to? What was his motivation? What was the puzzle that he had in his mind? You know, what motivated him to go off into the world and do all this? And the answer is colonial oppression and exploitation. Now, this is real. This oppression and exploitation is real. I know those words get thrown around a lot, but like, okay, one example for listeners is if you're interested, there's a book called The Red Earth, A Vietnamese Memoir of Life on a Colonial Rubber Plantation by Chan Tu Binh. And so it's important to talk about this, okay? When the French were in Vietnam, like many colonial powers, European colonial powers, they want the three G's, gold, God, and glory. So by gold, we mean they want economic prosperity. They want cheap labor. They want resources. What resources? There were a few in Vietnam, but one was especially rubber. Rubber at the time was really, really important. Henry Ford is famous for making the assembly line. It was around this time, the 19-teens, where Henry Ford perfects the assembly line. And what corporation, what company do you have in Vietnam? The Michelin Tire Company. This is a French tire company created in 1889. I know the word Michelin through its ratings of great restaurants today, and that's wonderful. That's great. I went to a Michelin star restaurant in Hanoi recently, and that's fantastic. However, back in the 19-teens and 1920s and so on, Michelin really meant death for the Vietnamese. If you look at these plantations, okay, take, for example, the Phu Rinh plantation, 17% of workers, according to the Michelin records, died working there just in 1 year in 1927. About 17,000 deaths between the two world wars, just working on these rubber plantations. And these are conservative estimates. So workers suffered appalling, humiliating treatment, beatings. So there were overseers who had spacious living quarters. Meanwhile, workers worked 12 hours a day in the heat. They were given about 15 minutes of rest in the middle of the day. Many of them were crushed by trees. Many of them were given barely anything to eat. And so workers sang songs at these plantations. And one song went, "How healthy and beautiful are the rubber trees. Under each of them, a corpse of a worker is buried." So I'm just talking about the rubber plantations here. There were also Vietnamese peasant farmers outside the plantations who were subjected to what is famously called corvée labor. Now, corvée labor is unpaid labor, introduced in 1901, and it required male peasants to complete 30 days of unpaid work on buildings, roads, dams, and other infrastructure. Now, the French, they want to increase efficiency. Okay, this is capitalism. Your aim is to make as much profit as possible. And so what they do to increase the efficiency of resource extraction and production, what they do is they take land from peasants and they concentrate it into the hands of a new class of landlords, of Vietnamese landlords. So through French capitalism, the colonial project, we have a rising class of Vietnamese landlords. Now, imagine if you're a peasant, you're now dispossessed. What do? Life is awful. You might turn to drugs, okay? You consume opium and rice alcohol. The French monopolize and profit from those industries as well. Okay, here's the point that I'm trying to make. Colonial oppression and exploitation and racist dehumanization of the Vietnamese by the French is something very real. It's not imagined. This is what Ho Chi Minh is going to respond to. This is going to be his puzzle. Why is this happening? And what can be done about it? These are his core motivating questions in his younger years, in his teens and 20s.
You know, what's difficult today to imagine is having another country from some far-off place come to your country, and all of a sudden you're shackled as a slave in your own country, and you're working on a plantation, a rubber plantation, and you have no reason, you don't understand why this is even happening. You have no idea. And for 100 years later, for free people all over the world to think about that scenario, it's almost unfathomable to think about that happening.
Ken, I'm holding in my hands a phone, an iPhone right now. This is actually not unimaginable. Right now, as we speak, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, there are cobalt mines being mined by companies. At the bottom of the supply chain of our rechargeable batteries, there are people being crushed in the mines. Now, there's a book that recently came out called Cobalt Red. It's about these mines in Africa. I mean, if you watch the videos, I recently showed my students these videos right now. Thousands of people at the bottom of these mine pits, no safety equipment. They are literally being crushed, digging for cobalt. Women, children, today, as I speak right now. So we might not call this colonialism, but it is exploitation. And this is really important to talk about, Ken, because now, maybe I'll mention this now. So actually, no, I'll save it for later. But Ho Chi Minh is responding to specifically capitalism. And we're going to talk about this as we go on. But now at this point, what I want to do is I want to give a quick bio of Ho Chi Minh. Okay, so let's do that. Ho Chi Minh was born as Nguyen Sinh Cung, and he would go by many, many, many names throughout his life. There is dispute about the year he was born, but the official birth year, according to the Vietnamese government, is 1890. His father, Nguyen Sinh Sac, was a Mandarin, a Confucian scholar. He was also closely acquainted with Phan Boi Châu. And what's interesting here, jumping forward, is that Ho Chi Minh went to sea as a mess boy on a French ship in 1911. So he leaves Vietnam in 1911 when he's 21 years old, and he's not going to return until 1941. So after traveling for a few years, including perhaps to the United States, again, actually, there's no certain evidence that he went to the United States, but it's widely said that he went to the United States. He also went to various ports in Africa. And the point there is to say that he saw colonialism occurring in other parts of the world, not just Vietnam.
Wait, so there's no record of him in the U.S.? What does that mean? Because I've heard him living in Brooklyn as a, you know, as a young man.
Yeah, so Olga Dreher is quite insistent that we don't have hard evidence. We don't have hard evidence.
Let me call Olga up. I'm a friend of Olga. Yeah, I should have asked her.
Yeah, you sure. So he does go to London, and there he works as a snow sweeper. He works as a pastry chef. He works as a boiler operator. And I briefly want to pause here, and the reason why I'm saying these jobs is he has these letters to Phan Chu Trinh. By the way, side note, there are 12 volumes of Ho Chi Minh's writings edited by the government, and each of these volumes is about 600 to 800 pages. I know this through my research. And what's interesting is that the very first few writings of this whole set of writings are Ho Chi Minh's letters to Phan Chu Trinh. The young Ho Chi Minh sees Phan Chu Trinh as a mentor. Again, Phan Chu Trinh is old enough to be Ho Chi Minh's father here. So the point is that in these letters, Ho Chi Minh writes.
You said something. You said the government of Vietnam edited the letters. How do I know what I'm reading if these letters have been tampered with?
Excellent question, Cad. Excellent question. A few historians have told me to say, one should never, to be on the safe side, one should not say, Ho Chi Minh said, one should say, according to this text attributed to Ho Chi Minh. Mm. Yeah, so again, well, there are ways to cross-check. For example, Ho Chi Minh wrote writings in French that were published in journals in France, and they were translated to Gutngu, and you could check the translation if you read both languages. So anyway,
got it.
Okay. One of the letters that Ho Chi Minh writes to Fan Chuqin, I think, is quite striking. He talks about how he quit this job as a snow sweeper in London because it was so awful. Like, it was freezing cold. His hands would always, get numb. And so he works as a boiler operator. But this was actually worse because he's throwing coal into a stove. And so it's so hot down there, but then it's so cold outside, and the contrast of temperatures, he's always getting sick. The point I want to make there, and historians have made, is that Ho Chi Minh really was a laborer. He's not like Lenin or Mao. Lenin and Mao had getaway retreats, basically, where they could write theory and philosophize. Ho Chi Minh really was a laborer here. And as a result, also, he's always exposed to workers. And look at that image of the working in the boiler room. You're downstairs in the basement, throwing coal in this. Meanwhile, you don't see the people upstairs. He's developing a kind of class consciousness in these years. He's going to be exposed to the socialists. By the way, 1917, Ho Chi Minh goes to France, in war-torn France. And what else happens in 1917, 1918, elsewhere, in Russia, the Russian Revolution, okay? Hold that thought. So he's in France now. He's working as a photo retoucher in a shop managed by his mentor, Fan Chuqin. And one important event happens in the summer of 1919. The great powers are meeting in France, right, in Versailles, to talk about how to create a new world order. This is known as the Paris Peace Conference or the Versailles Conference. And at this conference, Ho Chi Minh delivers a list of demands to the delegates of the conference. This is really important, and we'll actually talk a little bit more about that list and who actually wrote it. But what I want to say here is that this is the moment that Ho Chi Minh enters world politics. Here's this young man. The French authorities don't know who he is, but he delivered a formal-looking list of demands. And so what did the French do? They hire police agents to follow Ho Chi Minh around. And from this, we actually have recordings, reproductions of dialogues that this Vietnamese informer gave to the French police. So the Vietnamese informer got to ingratiate him into Fan Chuqin and Ho Chi Minh's hangouts in Paris. And so they follow him around Paris from 1919 on and off until 1923. I'm just going to finish the bio here. Around 1920, he joins the faction of the French Socialist Party. And in December of 1920, they decide to join the Third International, basically to join the Russians and have a communist revolution. So he officially becomes one of the founding members of the French Communist Party. So, by the way, I wanted to show, for those watching this on YouTube, here he is at that conference. This is December 1920 at the Congress of Tours. And the quote above, this is, "Workers of the world, unite. Le prolétariat de tout pays, unissez-vous." Like, workers of the world, unite. And so you have, he's representing, that part of the world there. Okay. Now, from France, Ho Chi Minh goes to Moscow in 1923. This trip is organized by the Intercolonial Union, and he attends there the first Congress of the Peasant International. I'm just going to list a bunch of dates now. Okay. And then in 1924, he goes to Guangzhou or Canton, where he helps create what would become the Vietnamese Revolutionary Youth League, Thanh Niên. And this organization is expat Vietnamese, and it's one of Vietnam's first communist-oriented groups. In 1927, Chiang Kai-shek is anti-communist in China. He has a coup. It reaches Canton. So then Ho Chi Minh leaves China. He goes back to Moscow. And then he travels to Paris, Brussels, Berlin, and then to Siam or Thailand by 1928. And there he's in Siam, he's trying to mobilize ethnic Vietnamese to support the revolution. By mid-1929, he goes to Hong Kong. And in February 1930, he presides over the founding, and this is a big moment, it's the founding of the Vietnamese Communist Party. And there, the British police detain him for nearly 2 years, and then they expel him. So Ho Chi Minh, he hides somewhere in China, we don't know where, for some time. He goes back to Moscow in 1934, where he studies at the Communist University of the Toilers of the East. And then in 1938, he returns to southern China. And finally, from southern China, he returns to Vietnam in May of 1941. And there he meets with communists and he convinces them to join non-communist parties to focus on national liberation. And there this group becomes the Viet Minh.
Okay, I gotta stop you. As I'm listening to all of this history in his early years of traveling, I'm thinking there's many people like him doing the same thing, traveling, trying to kind of identify the pockets of revolution and bringing it back to Vietnam, figuring out technique. Why do you think Ho Chi Minh was so empowered and so revered when he came back to Vietnam? Because, you know, like I said, many other people did the same thing, but why was he listened to when he got back to form the Viet Minh?
Okay, here's the answer, I think. Here's what I will say. I'm going to have to jump to that part of this because, let me now talk about the transformation that happens in France. So before I continue with what he does in Vietnam after 1941, let me talk about what happens in France that makes him unique here, what makes him special in a sense. When he first arrives in France, and we know this through his letters to Fanchuchev, he was surprised when a French waiter in a cafe in Marseille called him Monsieur. Basically, a Frenchman called him Sir. No Frenchman before that had ever addressed him as an equal. To Ho Chi Minh, the French people in France seemed a lot nicer, not like the racist Frenchmen in Vietnam. What I think this means, here's my interpretation, is that this made Ho Chi Minh realize that the colonial system is what makes people racist and bad. The French are not naturally racist. So Ho Chi Minh is going to, remember, he's going to travel around Africa, maybe he goes to the U.S., but he writes about lynchings of African-Americans in the U.S. You read these writings, they are gruesome. Like, he goes into deep, deep detail about lynchings. It's really horrific. And by the way, actually, we're going to come back to that when we talk about the capitalist part. But anyway, he's still under the sway of Fanchuchen at this point. He's still arguably, from the evidence we have, and this is maybe controversial, he still believes in liberal reform. Okay? Fanchuchen certainly did. Now, what happens is that his letter, this is where I want to talk about his letter, which will answer your question. This letter that he writes, he did not write it himself. He also wrote it with Fanchuchen and Phan Van Trieu. It was most likely written by Phan Van Trieu, who was very fluent in French. He was a lawyer working in France. They write this list of demands, and let me read them out to you. Number one, amnesty for political prisoners. 2, equality under the law. 3, freedom of speech. 4, freedom of association. 5, freedom of travel. 6, freedom of education. 7, rule of law. And 8, representation. Did they ask for independence? Any guesses?
No, I don't think that they did.
They did not ask for independence. This kind of blows my mind when I first realize this, when I first serious historians make this point. But if you watch documentaries, popular documentaries about the Vietnam War, they always mention this, and they always mistakenly say that they asked for independence. They did not. And actually, Ken, I want to pause here and ask you, there's a list of eight things. Do you think that the French could still maintain their colonial authority if they gave the Vietnamese all those eight things?
I think so. I think they could. And I think the reason why revolutionaries didn't ask for independence was because maybe the colonial people, the French that came in, also brought some benefits with arriving to Vietnam, maybe. And so maybe they didn't ask for independence because they maybe needed the resources and the command infrastructure that the French brought in. I don't know. That's just my guess.
That's an interesting answer. I've asked this to other people, and others have said, actually, if you give the Vietnamese those eight things, by definition, you cannot have colonialism. Because if you get the Vietnamese representation, the definition of colonialism is political domination. But if you give them representation, well, then there's no more domination, maybe. Anyway, that's an interesting question. So what happens? Ho Chi Minh delivers this list of demands. The delegates acknowledge receiving it. But what happens is Ho Chi Minh feels ignored. He was able to get a meeting with Albert Sarraut, actually. But he feels that they just didn't even care to seriously respond to the demands, okay? And he feels rejected. So I'm going to suggest that this rejection at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 is the turning point. This is what radicalizes Ho Chi Minh. Now, what I just said, I think, is controversial because some people are, historians are going to say, no, he was radical before that. Like there was never this Woodrow Wilson moment. But I think I'm going to differ from them because if you get down to the months, like what actually happens is what he does is he feels rejected and then he gets into a big argument with Fan Chu Trinh late at night in their apartment at 6 Villa des Gobelins. And here's the dialogue. I want to read the dialogue to you. We know this dialogue through one of the Vietnamese informers that the French hired. So here's what happens one night after the Ho Chi Minh feels rejected. Fan Chu Trinh says to Ho Chi Minh, "Brother Quốc, allow me to observe, you're still very young, and everyone can see that you're too headstrong. You want 20 million of our compatriots to do something when they have no weapons to oppose the terrible weapons of the Europeans. Why should we commit suicide for no purpose?" How do you think Ho Chi Minh responds?
Better to live or better to die than to live in chains. I don't know. That's a guess.
Ho Chi Minh responds by saying, "Why don't our 20 million compatriots do anything to force the government to treat us as human beings? We are humans and we must live as humans. Anyone who does not want to treat us as his fellow man is our enemy. We don't want to live with them on this earth. You are older and more experienced than I, but our compatriots have been demanding reforms for 60 years and have received what? Very little." So pretty close to what you said. So what Ho does next is he tries to publish this list of demands by going to newspaper houses in Paris. And pretty much everybody ignores him except Jean Longuet. He's one of the leaders of the French socialists, and he's warmly sympathetic to Ho Chi Minh. He also happens to be Karl Marx's grandson. So Ho Chi Minh starts going to the French socialist meetings. As I had mentioned, they're debating should they join the Russians in this communist revolution. And someone at one of these meetings gives Ho Chi Minh a pamphlet that's going to change everything, the course of history, pretty much. At these meetings, Ho Chi Minh, his French is okay. It's not great, but soon he's gaining confidence because his French is improving. And he's going to ask them, "You all care about oppressed people, but it seems like nobody's talking about colonized peoples. You're just talking about workers in Europe. But so in response, somebody gives him Lenin's thesis on the national and colonial questions. This is 1920. And this is a very famous passage that Ho Chi Minh writes. He says, in those theses, there were political terms that were difficult to understand, but by reading them again and again, finally I was able to grasp the essential part. What emotion, enthusiasm, enlightenment, and confidence they communicated to me. I wept for joy. Sitting by myself in my room, I would shout as if I were addressing large crowds. Dear compatriots, this is what we need. This is our path to liberation. Since then, I had entire confidence in Lenin in the Third International.
Okay, can I stop you? I think growing up for me, I never really grasped the sort of ethos of the South government, where we're children of the South. I never felt like there was this sort of deep reason for being. When I listened to Ho Chi Minh and the path that he took and this sort of awakening to say, hey, we don't want our people shackled. We don't want our people enslaved. There's this through line that will drive you to no end to get what you want, which is independence, or, you know, to break free from the French. But when I think about like my grandfather who served under the French, and his friends served under the French, and I have many friends my age now in their 50s that their grandfathers were also French-serving people and who were assassinated by the Viet Minh, like my grandfather. My grandfather was assassinated by the Viet Minh, which makes me think, I wish my dad was still alive so I can ask him the very question, will we serve the French? Where is it possible to have a doctrine to go into the jungle and fight for many decades and die for your country the way the communists have, right? We're sort of like serving the white man, right? And this is what I get crucified at parties for saying this, but I'm just speaking the truth. I'm just wondering, I'm not taking sides. I'm just wondering what has driven the doctrine of the South. Who is like the Ho Chi Minh of the South, where they're holding a flag and saying, look, this is the right doctrine. This is the right way to think of it. Here's the theory that we have to like, here's the framework. Ho Chi Minh has a framework. He's thought about it. He lived it. Where is the South's voice?
In our episode on Ngô Đình Diệm, we have talked about his purported doctrine, personalism. One significant advantage that the communists had that the anti-communists did not have was exactly what you said, a doctrine, a coherent, well thought out collection of thought, actually. So this is a great segue here. So Lenin's theses essentially argued that the Communist International should try to unite peasants and workers in all countries, in all lands. And so Ho Chi Minh says, after a time of waiting and study, we realized that the Wilson Doctrine, so Wilson had talked about self-determination, was but a big fraud. The liberation of the proletariat is the necessary condition for national liberation. Both these liberations can only come from communism and world revolution. Now, here is where I want to talk about this doctrine. We have to. Like any young Vietnamese American, by the way, who's listening, you grew up, you probably hear these words, communism, communist. We need to know what these words actually have stood for to the people who have identified as them, okay? And so you're totally right, Ken. The anti-communists just did not have writings and a doctrine like the communists did. Now, we have to talk about Marx. I'm going to give like my 4-minute like breakdown of what Marxism is, a very brief introduction. Now, I do want to say that Ho Chi Minh, his understanding of Marxism, Leninism,
was in the beginning quite not as sophisticated, but it later will be. And definitely when you have theorists like Zhong Qin or Lei Zuan, like these people really did, like you read their writings and okay, this is an orthodox Marxist here. And by the way, personally, I have many friends who identify as Marxists. And so my teen years have been spent discussing this stuff. And so, okay, here's a really quick—
Don't apologize, Kevin, just go for it.
I'm not apologizing here, but okay, basically—
Sorry, I didn't mean to offend you.
No, yeah. Marx and Engels argued that all societies have producers and non-producers, and that the producers must produce more than they can consume. What do you call that? It's called the surplus. This is necessary for the survival and reproduction of society. And so, if you want to understand anything about a society, according to Marx and Engels, if you want to understand their ideas or whatever, you need to look at these two questions. You need to ask yourself, number one, who are the producers and non-producers? And number two, who takes the surplus and controls its distribution? So they believe that there are five forms of societies, and that history actually progresses through different stages and forms of ownership of the economy. Or they call these means of production, or the mode of production, sorry, the mode of production. So the history, you probably heard about this, all students have. For communists, the history of all societies is the history of class struggle. That's a very famous, right? So here's what Marx and Engels meant. You began with tribal societies, and this is actually not a class society. In tribal societies, you have hunters and gatherers. There's division of labor in the family. The point, though, is that there's no exploitation happening here. They produce enough to sustain themselves, and the people who produce the surplus are the same people who get the surplus and distribute it, okay? Then after that, you have what's called ancient communal or slave societies. So what happens is several tribes come together, they conquer and enslave others. This is the first class society, where you have masters who exploit the slaves. The slaves produce the surplus, the masters get all the product, and they distribute the surplus. The slave is the master's property, the slave can be bought and sold, okay? And then from there, you have a feudal society, like in the Middle Ages in Europe, okay? And in this mode of production, you have serfs who are bound to the land. They are not slaves, okay? They cannot be bought and sold. But what they produce belongs to the lord. And so you have that system. In the countryside, you have the lords exploiting the peasants. In the towns, you have masters of guilds exploiting workers. Now, from there, we have a revolution. It's called the French Revolution. You get rid of feudalism, you have the birth of capitalism. In capitalism, you have a new mode of production where you have the worker who is a free laborer. So the worker is not a serf, not a slave. The worker sells their labor for a wage, and the worker produces what the capitalist tells them to produce. How do capitalists make profit? According to Marx, the capitalist appropriates the surplus. It's kind of like stealing the surplus value that you're creating. So the capitalist does not pay the wage unless the worker's labor produces more value than the value of the wage. So like, I hope that makes sense. You know, like that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the capitalist, also known as the bourgeoisie, and the worker is a proletariat. So capitalism simply is private ownership of the means of production for private profit. And therefore, Marx and Engels saw that the next stage of history would be communism, because capitalism is actually necessary for Marx and Engels. I'm not going to say that they liked capitalism, but they saw capitalism as necessary. Why is capitalism good? Why is it necessary? Number one, the competition helps create technology. And that's actually something very helpful for the Marxists, because you know it's great to have a dishwashing machine. I don't have to spend time doing dishes, so I could spend time doing something else, painting, reading, flourishing as a human being. They had faith that maybe this technology produced by capitalism could be very good, because the Marxists, their goal was free time for everybody, for us to paint and do whatever we want, right? So they thought that capitalism paves the way for the next stage of history, which is communism. Okay, that was super fast. Yeah, go ahead.
I know this is going to be a controversial question, and I am apologizing for this question, but has there ever been a communist country that has been successful? And in terms of what do I define as successful? Able to compete in the big world, you know, the lives of their citizens, being, you know, close to first world. I know that that's not a PC thing to say, but in more developed countries, has there been a communist country that can, you know, have their citizens say, yeah, we are living a wonderful life, just like a fully developed country?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer this in one way. There are many different ways to answer this, but I really encourage listeners to listen closely to Ken's question and to really seek that answer out for yourself. Go online. Here's what I'm going to say. Ken, in 1979, there was a communist revolution in Grenada. Grenada is a tiny, small island in the Caribbean of black people, okay? Not many Americans know about this, but it was a communist revolution. And between 1979 and 1983, they improved on every conceivable objective measure: literacy, the number of doctors, health, homes being built. They nationalized the production in their country. What happens in 1983? Who is president of the United States? Reagan. He invades Grenada. And so one perspective, the sympathetic to communism perspective, would say, well, Grenada would have flourished if Reagan didn't invade and stomp out this communist revolution. And Reagan even said in his speeches, we thought it was going to be good for tourism. Like, oh, these Western capitalist nations, they just want these countries to be sources of cheap labor. But if your people are getting literate, well, it's harder to exploit them. You know, the capitalist countries just want them to be tourist destinations. And so, of course, you need to stomp out this communist revolution. And from the leftist perspective, the United States has a long history of stomping out communist revolutions. One other argument that you would probably find from Vietnamese people who are communists today, they would say, what did the United States do right after the Vietnamese communists won the war in 1975? What did they do? They put an economic embargo on Vietnam, preventing Vietnam effectively from trading with the rest of the world, except for Russia and the Eastern Bloc, right? So one argument from the communist perspective would be, well, if the capitalists didn't always stomp out or put an embargo on our projects, we could have it succeed. And so I gave the example of Grenada, but there are others. And I would encourage listeners, especially to try to listen to people who are sympathetic to communism to give these arguments. And now I'm not taking a position here. I'm just saying here are the ways that you can answer the question. Okay, now I want to go back to your question earlier, which is, how did Ho Chi Minh become the man, right? So he returns in 1941. How did he become the leader? Now, while in France, Ho Chi Minh had started publishing articles for a journal called Le Pariah, and he's arguing that the Vietnamese must adopt Marxism-Leninism. And these articles are now being smuggled into Vietnam, and that's how Vietnam becomes introduced to Marxism. It's through Ho Chi Minh's writings. And so you basically have like reading clubs among Vietnamese intellectuals, people who read, and they are organizing in the countryside. We saw this in the story of Nguyen Thi Dinh, in, you know, these secret groups being exposed to these ideas of communism. It's trickling in. In 1922, Ho Chi Minh receives a letter from Phan Chu Trinh, and I think I might have read this actually in our episode on Phan Chu Trinh, but essentially Phan Chu Trinh says, he says, I'm old.
you are a young theory stallion. It's now you have go to Vietnam. He kind of hands over the baton. Okay. I've done a lot of historical stuff. What I want to do now is look at the writings of Ho Chi Minh and what were his ideas really. Okay, so I'm going to divide this into two parts. One is that if you read his writings, man, they are just a lot of it. They almost seem like just lists of anecdotes describing French colonial abuse. Like, they really just go on and on. Like, here's a story, here's another story, here's another story. So I'm not going to give a lot, but I want to give listeners a taste of this. So Ho Chi Minh describes how a French man, quote, furiously jumped out and beat an enemy's man just because he dared to be curious and had the audacity to look at this European's house for a few seconds. He beat him and finally killed him with a gunshot to the head. A railway official used a rattan whip to beat a Tonkin chief. Another Frenchman punched and broke the skull of his driver. Another Frenchman let his dog bite an enemy's man and then tied the man's hands and kicked him to death. Another Frenchman heard a noise on the street, and as soon as he opened his door, a Vietnamese woman ran in, followed by a man chasing her. The Frenchman thought it was a native chasing a girl, then grabbed his shotgun and killed the man. It turned out to be a European, but when asked, the Frenchman replied, "I thought it was a native." So, like, his notebooks are just series of, like, stories like this. And he says, the list gets longer and longer every day. Now, what is important here, and the reason why I bring this up, is because what Ho Chi Minh is doing here is he's pointing out that one thing that makes colonialism wrong. Now, Ken, I think you and I have talked about the effects of colonialism on Vietnam, that there are some arguably beneficial things like science, technology, you know, certain ideas. But ultimately, for Ho Chi Minh, what makes colonialism wrong are these two words, arbitrary violence. It's not just violence, but the fact that it's arbitrary. What I mean by that, arbitrary does not mean simply random or unpredictable. But what this means is that based on the will or whim or pleasure of the person who has power, they can do whatever they want to you. Now, you can make an argument, and I'm not making this argument, but one might make the argument for slavery and say, well, if you have a slave master who's really nice, who treats their slave well, then slavery could be good. Well, here's what's wrong with that argument. What's wrong is that, yes, the slave master can be very nice and friendly and treat the slave well, but they also don't have to. And the fact that they don't have to means that if they for pleasure or on a whim decide to hurt the slave, they're not going to be held accountable. That's what the problem is. That's called, in political philosophy, it's called domination. That I actually like to, no, I won't get into this, but should I? No.
Yes, you should. And whenever you say, should I get into something, you should be getting into it. Yes. Whenever there's some
This is such a sidetrack, but we're talking about power relations and domination. I mean, in the United States, there's tipping culture. In Amsterdam, we don't have to tip, okay? But in tipping culture, I would consider that to be a form of domination, because what happens is that when I go to the U.S., okay, I tip 20% when I eat at a restaurant because it's expected. But if I don't, I will not be fined by the police. I won't go to jail. Okay, there's nothing the server can legally do. And in that sense, the server is being dominated, because I won't get in legal trouble if I don't tip. So that's the point I'm trying to make here, is that colonialism allows the colonizer arbitrary violence. Okay.
Yeah. So then I think that's not anything controversial. I could follow that. We're not near the end, but we probably are gonna need to do a part two, because there's just so much questions that I have, but one burning question I have is, up to this point, like this last hour, I don't see anything wrong with Ho Chi Minh. And
we're going to get there. That's the next part right now.
Yeah. But my worry is that we don't have enough time to really dig into it or keep the audience's attention. I mean, we might get into it and we might, you know, keep this going, but does it deserve its own episode?
Let's do part two, because I also don't want to rush through this, and I feel like I have been kind of rushing because
I think today is like, all right, well, we talked about the good things, we talked about why he became who he became, and I think we can keep talking for a little bit more, but I think the next episode is how we get into the maybe the terror of what our families sort of like lived through, if I could even say that.
Good. I'm glad you're proposing this, because the next part is where I want to talk about his political theory, and I do find that there are issues there.
Okay.
So I think that let's save that for a part two. But I guess for now, then, let's maybe reflect. Let me ask you, Ken. I've done a lot of talking. I mean, what stood out to you, you know, in this whole run through of Ho Chi Minh's bio and everything else?
You know, I kept thinking about what my older brothers in my community are thinking as they're listening to this right now. The guys that are in their 60s, 70s, you know, guys that I call older brother, Aang. I call them Aang, and I myself am. And when I hang out with these wonderful human beings, you know, it's automatic that Ho Chi Minh is a bad person. However, I don't think we ever talk about what led Ho Chi Minh to believe and become who he's become. And I'm so happy that we are talking about this, because there can't be somebody who's out there who's a complete villain, right? There's got to be some sort of like origin story. And I think we're listening to it. And I frankly probably agree with a lot of the origin story, but I know that there probably was a tipping and turning point in Ho Chi Minh's history that divided the nation. And I think that's...
Certainly. Absolutely. And I have that all ready to go, but I think we'll save that for the next
part. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a part three to this either, because, you know, part two, we could talk about for easily an episode of how this all went dark. And then I think part three is actually really talking about the idea of Ho Chi Minh City today. It is the place where his name exists on a placard on everywhere you go. And, you know, that's just...
Yeah. Good. So for the listener, okay, so in today's episode, what we did was I offered essentially the puzzle that Ho Chi Minh was trying to figure out. And the puzzle was simply, what is happening to our people? And the answer he gets is capitalist colonial exploitation, that colonialism is an outgrowth of capitalist logic, that you need, capitalism demands the spread to other lands to get cheaper resources. So he has figured out the diagnosis, Ho Chi Minh. In the next episode, what we're going to talk about is Ho Chi Minh's prescription. What is to be done? And this is where we have time to think critically about, okay, that could be problematic here. Oh, this is what divided the nation. Okay, so that's good.
Thank you so much for today, Kevin. Once again, you always bring the A game to these discussions, and I really can't wait to get into the next one, because the next one is really where I think there's a lot of debate and heated discussion can happen, and that's important.